Hello. My name is Dipuma Seven. This is the Commercial Awareness Podcast, episode 55. I can't breathe. To be honest, my mind wasn't really on commercial awareness this past week, as there are much more significant events going on in the world. Worldwide protest campaigning for Black Lives to Matter. Simply matter. Not more than any other race, but simply matter in societies that often make us question whether they do in the eyes of those in authoritative positions. I could not stay silent, as it seems there are some people who don't believe that people who look like me even deserve to breathe. Archbishop Desmond Tutu once said, "If you are neutral in situations of injustice, you have chosen the side of the oppressor." In saying that, I'm aware that in our gold profession, there is often a tacit policy of impartiality, silence, and neutrality. But at the same time, there are some arguments that are so clear-cut to me that to see both sides would be reckless, negligent, and vile. There should be no neutrality when the options are between racism and anti-racism. There should be no neutrality when we ask ourselves whether all races are equal or not equal. There should be no neutral stance when the question is whether Black lives matter or do not matter. None of this should even be controversial. In fact, I'd argue it is our responsibility. Part of the SRA principles, the principles which govern solicitors, require each current and aspiring solicitor to act with honesty, integrity, and in a way that encourages equality, diversity, and inclusion. Everything I have said to you is in line with those principles. I will never tell you what to think, only what my views are. Black lives matter. If that pinches a nerve, I sincerely implore you to dig deep and ask yourself why. If you agree that Black lives do in fact matter, the first link in the description of this episode is a landing page where you can sign petitions and donate to the victims and nonprofit organizations campaigning for racial equality. Now, the headlines. The Bank of America became the first major bank to vow monetary support in response to police brutality, pledging $1 billion to help communities across the U.S. to address economic and racial inequality. In a follow-up from episode 47, and in particular the oil price war, OPEC leaders and Russia have agreed on a preliminary deal to extend their oil output agreement by another month. KPMG has told staff they pledge to, quote, stand in support, end quote, of black communities across the world, and set an objective of having 11% of its worldwide partners come from BAME backgrounds by 2022. According to the British Retail Consortium, retail prices in May, quote, fell at their fastest rate since 2006, as retailers ran promotions to encourage consumer spending and attempted to mitigate recent losses, end quote. In law firm updates, Simmons & Simmons staff have been asked to take a 20% cut to their pay and working hours for up to 6 months, and in a follow-up from episodes 28 and 53, Reed Smith has begun a redundancy consultation process in its London office, seeking to cut a, quote, small number, end quote, of lawyers and staff in its firm to cut costs. And finally, Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey has told UK banks to accelerate preparations for a no-deal Brexit. If you'd like to read more on any of these stories, links as always are in the description. This week's format is two longer reads. The first of the longer reads is that Nissan COO Ashwani Gupta has said that the company would not be able to commit to keeping their Sunderland plant open if Britain left the EU without a trade deal. In his words, he said, quote, "You know we are the number one car maker in the UK and we want to continue. We are committed. Having said that, if we are not getting the current tariffs, it's not our intention, but the business will not be sustainable. That's what everybody has to understand," end quote. The Sunderland plant employs 7,000 people, and the EU is its biggest market. Its profitability relies on the zero tariffs, and a no-deal Brexit would replace zero tariffs with WTO tariffs after the transition period ends, 31 December 2020. That's all that really needs to be said in the story, so let's analyze it. First of all, this is in some way a follow-up for a number of headlines and stories we've covered since the fruition of the podcast. This has been the manufacturer's relationship with Brexit, and in particular, a no-deal Brexit. Episode 8 actually discussed the chief executive of Airbus, Tom Enders, stating that Airbus would, quote, redirect future investments, end quote, in the event of a no-deal Brexit. Even all the way back in Episode 6, both Ford and Jaguar Land Rover warned of extensive job cuts if Britain left the EU without a trade deal. The CEO of PSA, Vauxhall's parent company, has also said work would be relocated from Vauxhall's Cheshire plant in the event of a no-deal Brexit. We last spoke of that in episode 27. This all came to a head in episode 37, when then-Chancellor Sajid Javid said that the UK does not intend to be in the single market or customs union post-Brexit and would seek regulatory divergence from the EU. This brought its own issue, the analysis of which was quite extensive in episode 37, but to summarize, though none of those views were all that surprising, regulatory divergence would result in car makers in Britain spending more money to gain certification for their models in both Britain and the EU. So in short, if the main market is in the EU, it would make more sense to simply build the cars in the EU. This would result in less investment, fewer jobs, fewer businesses, and ultimately fewer clients for lawyers in the UK. Granted, since then, Rishi Sunak has replaced Javid as Chancellor, and has not commented on whether the UK is taking a different stance than the stance reported on in episode 37. As we've always said for commercial awareness, sometimes it's about news that affects firms directly, sometimes it affects its clients or an industry, and other times it's a mix. This is such a mix. So, as we've already said, a no-deal Brexit is rather unfavorable for both motor and aviation, and in particular, the manufacturing arms of these businesses. Now, let's see what it means for law firms. In the short term, this piled with the pandemic means a lot of restructuring work for firms. As car and plane manufacturers seek to cut costs, they scale down businesses and sometimes close entire plants, with the most recent example being Renault in episode 54's headlines. The restructuring teams will therefore have work as these companies respond to the pandemic and a potential no-deal Brexit, together with employment teams if any redundancies are announced, and even real estate teams if any leases need to be renegotiated. But in the long term, if businesses do perform this forewarned exodus from Britain, the client pool shrinks. A smaller client pool is not ideal for law firms. When we discussed MW Solicitors' pre-pack administration in episode 53, I did not mention that within that discussion of law firms and their financial worries, Steve Cotty, restructuring partner at Pinson Masons, told guests at a Barclays-hosted breakfast last year that, quote, unfortunately, there are too many law firms, end quote. This is an issue that can only be exacerbated by a no-deal Brexit. As more firms vie for fewer and fewer clients, the less financially healthy firms will have to make some tough decisions. Redundancies, restructuring, consolidation through mergers, or, of course, more pre-pack administrations. So, to sum up, a no-deal Brexit could mean lower manufacturing output in Britain, which means some work for law firms in the short term, but a potentially smaller client pool in the long term. Smaller client pool would put stress on an issue that already exists, which is a large number of firms, plus the Big Four's legal arms, plus ABSs, all vying for the same work. In closing, it's something I stress often, but this story allows me to stress it again. You may be asked what is going on in the world that would affect a firm's clients or firms directly. You may be compelled to say Brexit or the pandemic, and though these are both correct answers, they are both so large and wide-ranging that it is important to have specific stories on hand to demonstrate that you've done your research into your targeted firm's clients and practice areas. Now, you'll have this story on hand for firms with real estate, restructuring, and employment practices, and clients in motor and aviation. Credit for this story goes to James Davey, Liz Piper, and Barclays Corporate. The second and final read is that blue chip companies have stopped using commercial paper during the pandemic. We don't talk about banking and finance law often enough, and during times of economic downturn, it's rather relevant. A few definitions to start with. A blue chip is a label given to a select number of companies that are well established in their sector and have a reputation of being financially stable and profitable, even in times of economic downturn. Examples of a few blue-chip companies are Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, IBM, Walt Disney, GSK, and Pfizer. It's also interchangeable with the term blue-chip stocks, as the idea is that these companies are so well-established and financially stable that although any investing involves risk, investing in these companies is the closest thing you can get to an assured return. Since we're here, the name actually comes from blue chips in poker, which are traditionally seen as the highest value chips. As these companies are almost assured return, their stock price is quite high. The more you know. But for the purposes of this story, just think of blue chip as the very large, profitable companies. In fact, commercial paper by its nature can only really be used by well-established, reputable companies. Now, what is commercial paper? After that long-winded explanation for blue chip, I offer you the short definition of commercial paper first, then a long-winded one. First, it is a short-term debt instrument used by companies or banks or building societies to finance working capital or short-term liabilities like monthly wages, inventories, and so on. Now, the long-winded definition. In function, it is a promissory note these companies sell to potential investors. The note has a value known as a par value, and it is sold to these investors at a discount from that par value with a promise by the company, known in this transaction as the issuer, that they will repay that investor an amount equal to the par value. So instead of formal interest, the company is merely promising to, in a way, buy back that promissory note for more than they sold it for. The company or issuer benefits by getting money to use in the short term, the investor benefits by being paid back more than what they paid at the earlier date. As it is a short-term debt instrument, the date at which the company is to pay back the investor, also known as the maturity date, is usually not more than a few months, but that maturity date can range from a few days to a year depending on the commercial paper. Disclaimer, even that is a bit of a simplification. In practice, commercial paper also involves a bank to set up the program for the issuance and a dealer to find investors. Banking and debt finance law can be a lot. Why can commercial paper only really be used by well-established, reputable companies? That statement I made not too long ago? Because commercial paper is unsecured, meaning it is not backed by any collateral such as real estate or assets. This means that only companies with high credit ratings, also known as investment grade ratings, will find investors for commercial paper, as companies with a low credit rating, also known as speculative grade, would find it more difficult to borrow money in this way. So, that's a summary on commercial paper, but in case I've lost you, just remember that it is a way for commercial entities, banks, and building societies with good credit ratings to raise money for short-term overheads. With all of that out of the way, back to the story. As a result of the pandemic, dozens of these blue-chip companies have paid off their commercial papers and opted for longer-term debt facilities. Namely, Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, Walt Disney, Pfizer, and Philip Morris have all issued longer-term debt to pay off their short-term commercial paper. Part of the thinking behind this is to, as you can imagine, address the upcoming maturity dates for the commercial papers, pay any overheads, have working capital, and have money in the reserves in one go, preparing the companies for a less than favorable time for businesses. The other benefit, of course, is a later maturity date. However, this was also influenced by a period in March where, according to the Financial Times, investors also rocked by the pandemic would not buy commercial papers with maturities longer than just 5 days. So, a little from column A, a little from column B. But all technical terms aside, this news only confirms what we should intuitively know. Currently, a number of companies in some industries are facing significant economic downturn. However, the overheads aren't stopping, and working capital is still required. A company could get a short-term loan or debt instrument, but it's risky as business may have not rebounded by the time the money needs to be repaid. As a result, a long-term option is more favorable. In fact, this actually seems to be the pattern during a financial crisis, as Refinitiv data suggests. Companies have raised £76 billion in debt this year, not too far off from the £83 billion borrowed between 2008 and 2009 for the last financial crisis. So, just in case the podcast is no more by the time the next financial crisis rolls by, you can make a similar inference that companies will seek longer-term financing solutions compared to short-term. If you'd like an illustration of what other kinds of companies may require loans, think of EasyJet from episode 52. Sir Stelios was unhappy with the £600 million loan the company took from the UK Treasury, but that wasn't the only loan. EasyJet took out other loans secured against aircraft amounting to about £900 million, all to give the company enough liquidity to prepare for a 9-month grounding of planes. And even with a cash balance of now £3.3 billion, Chief Exec of EasyJet, Johan Lundgren, said that if a grounding lasts longer than 9 months, they, quote, will look toward additional funding, end quote. And that brings us to why all of this matters for our commercial awareness. It provides us with another specific story in relation to what challenges the pandemic brings for law firms and their clients. As short-term financing is switched for longer-term financing, those companies' lawyers will be working hard to decide what type of loan or debt instrument should be used, for how long, and what documents need to be drafted and negotiated. Commercial paper is not the only form of short-term debt finance. There is a myriad of options for long-term finance as well. In fact, for the £900 million EasyJet raised independent of the Treasury loan, that involved three different forms of financing, which meant three different agreements, three parties or groups of parties, and three sets of terms. Borrowers and issuers aren't the only parties who need lawyers either. Banks and loans, for example, also require solicitors to conduct some due diligence into the borrower, to draft the loan documentation, and also draft what is called a legal opinion, where a bank solicitor must draft a document telling the bank whether the loan documentation is valid and enforceable, and whether any terms carry legal risk. So, this is a process with a lot of work for lawyers. And like this story has shown us, this work doesn't stop in times like these. So, this was a very long read. The only question I really have for you at the end of it is, has this story made you more or less interested in banking and finance law? And I sincerely hope I explained all of this well enough so we can potentially talk more about banking and finance next week. Credit for this story goes to Eric Platt, Colby Smith, Peggy Hollinger, Tanya Powley, and James Chen. This has been the Commercial Awareness Podcast. Please be sure to follow, subscribe, and rate the podcast on your listening platform. It goes a long way. Also, recommend it to a friend. If you need to contact me, the podcast email address is on the first line of the episode description, and the podcast Instagram page is at ComAwarePod, that is ComAwarePod, if you prefer to contact me there or just want to follow the podcast there for any updates. The podcast Instagram page is also a way to interact with the podcast where you can participate in polls to reflect on past episodes and suggest topics for future episodes. Other than that, thank you for listening, and you'll hear from me next week.